Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Justin Gregg. He's a senior research associate with the Dolphin Communication Project and an adjunct professor at St. Francis Xavier University. And we're talking about his new book, If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal, What Animal Intelligence Reveals About Human Stupidity. Justin, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm very excited to be here, Mark.
I have to say, I think this is going to be one of my top 10 books of the year. And one of the reasons is, first of all, it deals with a subject I'm fascinated about, intelligence, consciousness in both humans and animals, but in a very different way. And the book has a certain flow to it. We were talking about this off mic. And I want to encourage everybody, if you start reading, you think it's one thing, stick with it, because this really builds up to a rather important conclusion. What put you on this pathway, Justin, to write this book?
Well, I study animal intelligence, and I teach animal cognition and things. And I often find myself explaining animal behavior and animal intelligence by comparing it to human behavior, because that's the easiest way to,
right,
to get into the subject, right? And after a while, I got kind of tired always having to explain. I'm like, well, when a squirrel does that, it's very similar to how humans do. So therefore, they're kind of intelligent, like a human is. And then I'm like, well, wait a second. Why are we always comparing everything to human intelligence as if the baseline best kind of thinking is human? I'm like, so maybe human intelligence, A, isn't that great, and B, might actually be a really bad thing. So that was the premise.
That's the thing that throws the monkey wrench into all of what you thought this book was going to be about, because literally you question all those pre-assumptions that we have. I mean, everybody assumes, hey, we're humans. We're the rat's rear end.
Yeah, well, why would you not think that? I mean, on one hand, it's obvious. Like, we went to the moon. You know, we invent, like, vaccines, and we have science. It's like, we live really extraordinary lives compared to other species. So you look at that and you think, well, obviously, we're the bee's knees. But then you look at the news headlines, for example, and you see, like, the climate emergency and all the terrible things that you do, and you're like, hold on a second. We might not last very long as a species, at which point, well, what good is all that intelligence doing us if we're gone in 300 years?
And that opens the door to how we define intelligence. Like, what is intelligence for species, including humans? I mean, being able to remain alive and successful and succeed as a species seems to be a pretty important thing. And if we just seem to be creating more ways that we're going to exterminate ourselves.
Well, that's it. I mean, everything we do, which is amazing, is essentially, it's a double-edged sword. Like, language is fantastic. You know, our ability,
right,
to understand cause and effect. These are amazing things. That's what gives us all this technology. And as much good as we do with these things, we do bad things. It's like nuclear energy. Like, as soon as you can split the atom, great, you can create electricity, but you can also drop it on a city and kill a million people. And so it's bad and good at the same time. So the question is, like, on balance, is it going to be worse for us or better for us as a species?
And the bad part of that equation is really bad, because we could screw things up not just for our species, but for the entire freaking planet.
Well, that's it. I mean, on one hand, you can make really bad movies, and you're like, well, that's a real waste of our intelligence.
Right, right.
Look at this. Look, Jaws 4. What a ridiculously terrible movie. But on the other hand, you can make bad things that just seem objectively bad, like from a moral perspective, like the destruction of the planet that we live on. So there's bad, then there's real, real bad.
And the great thing about this book is you investigate why those things, why we think that way, that brings that upon us. And that's the real meat and potatoes of this book. It's not just that you make statements. You look at scientific evidence. You look at things that people have discovered about animal intelligence and animal behavior, and bring the whole thing together. And that's what's really wonderful about this book. Now, I have to ask you, Nietzsche.
Okay.
Yeah. Why Nietzsche?
Well, it's really quite a simple explanation, which is Nietzsche, he had this one passage that he wrote where he was talking about cows that he was looking at in a field. And he was like, oh, it'd be so great to be a cow, because he thought they were sort of stuck in the moment. They didn't worry about the past or the future. They just ate grass and didn't have to worry about all these existential problems. So he envied being a cow. He also pitied them. He's like, it's too bad they can't think about their own mortality. And so that was the standpoint that he had that I had then adopted. I'm like, well, are we better off with all this intelligence, or would it be better to be more like your cat or a chicken or a cow? And I explore it in detail. Of course, cows we know do have much more going on in their heads than we just thought. They do worry about the future and think about the past. But it is true, humans worry a bit more. We're worried about our own mortality and our inevitable deaths, and our cats probably don't worry to the same extent. So then the question is, would we be happier as a cat?
And the other thing is that as you delineate in the book, Nietzsche was a hot mess. So here you have this guy who's doing all this intellectual writing, but his life was a total mess.
Yeah. He had obvious mental health issues. It wasn't just that he was a sad philosopher, but at the same time, he was concerned with existential issues and issues of morality. So he ruminated on these things, and it made him a kind of miserable person. The experts say, like, on an everyday basis, he was a pleasant enough chap, but like ultimately his life was pretty terrible, I think, for the most part. And then the question is, okay, well, would he have been better off not worrying so much about nihilism? And that's the standpoint, yeah. His life was not improved by worrying too much about it, I have to say.
Well, starting with one of the big questions you address in this book, what is intelligence? I thought it was fascinating when you brought up the fact that people are doing research, scientists are researching AI, artificial intelligence, they're not really quite sure what intelligence is, yet they're working on it.
Yeah, that's what I love. I picked that field because it's literally labeled artificial intelligence. You think they'd have an operational definition, but they don't. Not one that they all agree on, which I think is just hilarious that a scientist studying something doesn't know necessarily what they're studying. But it really highlights the problem of when we say intelligence, we're talking about so many different things, so many things that the human mind is capable of doing that animals can do. And so that's in the book, instead of just like thinking of it as a singular concept, I'm like, well, let's figure out exactly what are the complex cognitive things individually that humans do in a sort of more extraordinary way than animals. So I pick individual elements of cognition and talk about those.
It was at this point in the book that I realized I was in for a different kind of experience than I thought the book was about, that we have a belief that intelligence is a good thing, and then you go, but is it? And then everything you start to think about sort of went, oh.
Oh. Yeah. That's it. I wanted to reframe the question because, a lot of people who write about animal behavior are always saying, like, well, animals are intelligent, too. Like, we're always fighting that corner. And that's one way to do it. And I'm like, you know what? No, we're going to do a whole new thing, which is maybe it's bad to be intelligent and animals are better off not being intelligent, which is it provides a whole different way into the material.
And it's interesting, and it brings up a lot of interesting perspectives on this question. The first chapter, where you talk about being humans are why specialists. Explain to me what you mean by that.
Yeah, that's the one thing I think that makes us the most human in terms of our thinking. And that's our interest in why things happen, our interest in cause and effect. So there are animals generally don't necessarily care or need to know. They can make causal inferences. Like, they know when one thing happens, another thing happens. And you can get really far in life. Animals have been doing that for millions of years. It's very effective. But humans want to know just not that these things are correlated, but that one thing causes the other thing. And that's when you get into science. I mean, that's all that science really is trying to sort out causation from correlation. And that is the basis of all, not just science and technology, but religion and philosophy and everything is based on that one thing that humans do that animals do not.
It was interesting, though. You were trying to trace the evolution of why. And you talked about that even our species for a long time got along just fine without asking why.
Well, that's it. I was intrigued by that because if you think about the, our species living in Africa, a couple hundred thousand years ago alongside chimpanzees, and our lives were quite similar. And we knew at the time, cognitively, humans were very similar to modern humans, could have thought about, nuclear fission or whatnot, but they just didn't because they were just as successful as chimpanzees hanging out, doing regular old survival stuff. So realizing that we spent tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of years without needing to use that ability shows you that it's really not that important as far as evolution is concerned.
And you also talk about animals, and animals are taught by their experience. But our minds, and this is quoting from your book, can search through a, quote, web of possibilities to seek an explanation for what is happening. Now, that sounds like a great thing overall, but it runs into problems pretty quickly.
It is a good thing to be able to think of any possible thing and to come up with these fantastical explanations. And generally, one of them is going to be true. But it also leads us down some really sort of a crazy path where we think we figured something out, and then we spend a few hundred years. Like ulcers. I love that example.
That's a great example. I grew up in the 50s, yeah. and everybody thought, and it was on sitcoms and everything, that you got ulcers from stress.
That's it. And even I, as a kid in the 80s, I'm a writer now. Obviously, I've been anxious my whole life. So in the 80s, I was diagnosed with an ulcer. And they're like, well, you're stressed out. Try and relax more. But no, that was the dominant paradigm for so long. And then we realized, someone discovered that, oh, no, it's caused by a bacteria. Like, that's it. But we fundamentally misunderstood it. We thought we figured out the causation, and we were wrong. And, science is just a whole, history of getting it wrong until we get to more accurate. What good is it?
Well, a worse example is humorism and Aristotelian thought. It's like people for the longest period of time did not want to contradict the findings of Aristotle.
Yeah, I love humorism. I bring it up in the book. My wife studies that because she studies Celtic studies, and she knows a lot about this. And it was just, it was the dominant paradigm in Europe for millennia.
And on purpose, like, we didn't want to contradict this. So people would come out with contrary findings.
Yeah.
But then they would throw those out because they contradicted Aristotle.
Well, that's exactly it. That's a whole question of how science moves forward at all. Because, the history of animal cognition is people also coming up with all these amazing findings, and it's contrary to what everyone thought they knew. And so no one believes it until eventually there's just so much evidence that you have to. And imagine that for centuries, finding all this information that, humorism might not be right, but it's going to take another 1,000 years before anyone believes you.
Well, and then that has to do with the structure of the universe, too. The Ptolemaic view of the universe, that we're all in these concentric circles with the Earth at the center. And then they would observe things that would contradict that. But then what they would do is refine the Ptolemaic system. So you would have these little retrograde motions where the planet would spin backwards in a little circle just to make sure that Ptolemy was right.
Yeah, and that's what's great about human thinking is we can use all of that intelligence and this inferential skills to just uphold the status quo or justify our actions or justify our current science. So that's a powerful skill that we have. We do it today. Think about vaccine denial or flat earthers. They're using all of their smarts to contradict what seems to be rather accepted objective facts, because that's what human intelligence is capable of.
Well, that also speaks to conspiracy theorists.
Yes, absolutely. It's the same thing. You're just looking for causation. We're always looking for a causation. That's what humans are after. And, conspiracy theorists are generally not right, but then sometimes they are. And even with physics, because we already, I don't know that much about physics, obviously, but you've got gravity and you've got quantum mechanics, and we know that they're not right. Right. And so we know that there's no way to square that, and there has to be some other explanation. But at the time right now, it's good enough. 100 years from now, they might look back at us and be like, oh, these ludicrous people, how could they believe in gravity being correct for so long like that?
Well, we know we're on the Earth, so something's there. Quantum theory, I've interviewed a lot of physicists, is it's completely contrary to what we think how the world works. So that's what upsets everybody, is that, it's just a lot of their answers is just shut up and accept it.
Yeah, exactly. Just shut up. That's how humorism worked for a long time as well. It's fine.
Well, my favorite example in that chapter has got to do with rooster butts.
Yeah.
For the benefit of the audience, give me the rooster butt story.
Yeah, this is a long accepted in Western Europe remedy for being bitten by a snake was you would rub the raw butt of either a rooster or a hen, depending on if it was a boy or a girl, human, onto the wound, and that would sort of suck out the poison. So, like, you know, 500 years ago, if you and I were walking in the woods and you got bitten by a puff adder, I would go grab my rooster and just rub its butt all over you, and that would be the best possible solution. Everyone would accept that. That's completely normal. Like rubbing bacitracin on a cut, you know, completely accept it.
Although you have to think, like, who was the first person that came up with that? Like,
I mean, well, who's the first person who decided to drink cow milk? There's so many questions
I know.
I have about.
And who ate the first mushrooms?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's really interesting when you talk about chimps in this chapter too, about being a Y specialist. And it's you talk about it was not an evolutionary triumph right out of the gate. You give an example of chimps and medicinal plants.
Yeah, it's chimpanzees, lots of species where if they have an upset stomach or they have parasites, they will go and eat a certain leaf that is known to have anti-parasitic properties. And that's something that they aren't born knowing. Obviously, they have to learn that information through trial and error, or maybe they've passed on that information culturally. That's something that chimpanzees are capable of doing. And they don't need to know why it makes them feel better. All they need to know is the correlation. When I eat this, if I have an upset stomach, I feel better. And that's how powerful correlation can be. You could, like, it would be the same for if humans had done ulcers correctly. Like if someone had accidentally eaten, you know, some antibiotic property substance and then gotten better from their ulcer, maybe we would have figured that out long before they figured it out recently. All through correlation, which that's how powerful causal or learned associations are.
It's fascinating because it seems like in the case of the chimps, they tried it and it worked, therefore they know that it works and they just do it.
Yeah.
When you're rubbing a chicken butt, there's nothing that's working, yet you're still rubbing the chicken butt. It's like, it's like old herbal medicine is if the plant was shaped like a human lung, if the leaf was shaped like a human lung, therefore it would treat the lungs. So that they're removed from the way the chimp is interacting with the environment. And we'll create weird reasons for things to happen.
Well, yeah, because it fits into a larger system about why rubbing a rooster on a snake wound should work, because this is the theory, the overarching why theory. It's just, yeah, if someone had actually gone and tested it out, which is what controlled trials are these days, like a chimpanzee might have, they would have said, like, well, I'm not rubbing a rooster butt on my snake bite because that doesn't work. But for some reason, nobody did that for centuries.
I love the fact that you end the chapter with, our feeling of superiority over your cat is just an illusion. But I thought that anyway.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, anyone who spends time around cats know exactly how they feel about us.
Yeah, oh, I'm really clear about it. Like, I'm a roommate in their house.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my cat right now. He's staring at me, judging what a terrible job I'm doing with this interview. I can just tell.
We can't go through all the stuff at all in this book, but there's one thing I definitely want to talk about because it's a lot of the information you come to seems to be so critical, not only over our politics, but over the way we think about the environment and a lot of other things. But there's a term, prognostic myopia. And can you explain to me what that is?
Yeah, that is this idea that humans and all animals are, for the most part, designed for solving problems in the moment. So, like, you feel hungry or you feel sad or you feel angry, it's because there's a problem happening right now that your brain is trying to get you to deal with. But humans are an exception in that we can think about the future, not just a few hours in the future, but like 10, 20, 30 years, 100 years into the future.
We can extrapolate information and create scenarios.
Yes, we can imagine ourselves in future scenarios, and that's something that animals sometimes do, but not to the same extent. I can think about 30 years, or you can think about 10 years, where you want to be, and think about your retirement savings or whatever. Animals can't do that. But the problem with that is that our biology isn't designed to give us a feeling or an emotional reaction to those future scenarios that's as strong as the here and now. And this is the impulse control problem that we all deal with all the time. is that we have to, you know, do the right thing for the future, but all we can think about is our feelings in the moment. So this disconnect between the way our system is designed to deal with the moment and the human ability to think about the far future is why we get so much stuff wrong, because we plan for the future in the wrong way. We're not using our emotions correctly.
It's amazing, and as you detail in the book, we think about climate change. We know climate change is happening now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt, and it's right in front of us, all the fires, all the other stuff that's going on. And so we know what we have to do, but we don't do it.
Yeah, it's possible to do it, but you have to really make policies that work around the
problem. Well, you have to work to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, that's it. We're all built to not worry about that sort of stuff. We want status quo, and we're dealing with our everyday problems. Like, I have to figure out what I'm going to have for supper tonight. That's my issue.
Right, right.
About 80 years from now, you know, whether or not my house is underwater, I've got problems in the now. And so to worry about those problems, you need to have some sort of mechanism, a global policy that fixes it. But if there's one thing humans do not do, it's create beneficial global policy.
Oh, my God. Well, it's all wrapped up in some kind of strange procrastination. I mean, it's like, yeah, I know I should be doing this. But, you know, now I just want to get supper and I'll think about it tomorrow. Or a month from now or whatever, and then you just get lost on it.
That's it. Prognostic myopia is just procrastination, but just like on steroids.
So we have this ability to create these fantastic, detailed, extrapolative scenarios, but we can't act on them.
Yep, because they don't feel important enough. They are something on paper. We just don't have an emotional response to them that guides our actions in the right way. Like if you could really truly feel what it would be like 80 years in the future when our grandchildren are having to deal with the fallout of climate change, and it was terrible, we would act now. We would act now with this feeling of absolute emergency and urgency. But we don't. We lack that ability.
But it's actually happening now. When you look at the temperatures this summer in India, I mean, there were people suffering in California, but as long as you're in the other states or some other place, you don't have to think about it. You brought up a fascinating example of Greta Thunberg.
Yes.
And why she's able to be so passionate and so clear about what needs to be done.
Yeah, she herself has credited her autism for being focused on a problem for so long and really feeling that problem. Which may be accurate for her. But nonetheless, whatever the reason, she has said in her speeches, I feel the panic. I feel this as an emergency. And there are other writers. There's the environmental activist Peter Kalmus, who's on, you should really read his tweets and his articles. He's saying, look, we need to feel this. This is a real emergency. But they are, unfortunately, the exception to the rule. Your average Joe, even people working on this issue, don't feel that level. And this is the problem we're talking about, which is feeling. Like, they are feeling the correct emotion for the problem, whereas people like me or your average person, I don't get my emotional threshold up that high. I just sort of am status quo, chill, procrastination.
Is it a conflict between our conscious and unconscious desires?
Well, it's conscious and unconscious is hard. It's hard to say in this case, because I don't know how that interplay would certainly happen, because it's an intellectual problem we're dealing with, but then the emotion is bubbling up from both an unconscious and a conscious place. So you're feeling that fight or flight, which can be unconscious, consciously. So you definitely have to be conscious to worry about this problem the right way.
There are so many chapters that are fascinating. We only have a few minutes left. Lying, the chapter on lying, was another one that just sort of took my breath away. Humans really have a capacity for lying.
Yes, and animals can be deceitful. You know, they can.
But is that the same thing? Is deceitful the same thing as lying?
Well, in the book, I make a distinction. No. So, in this sense, the way the humans do it is, I know something about your mind. I'm making guesses as to what you know and don't know and what you believe, and then I'm actively trying to change your beliefs by providing false information. And animals probably do not do that very often, if at all. So humans are real, real good at that, though.
Is mimicry a form of lying?
Well, no. It is providing false information, but it's unless you know, because you can have a bee that is, or a fly that it looks like a bee.
Yeah.
It's morphology. So animal communication systems are filled with incorrect information along those lines. But unless that bee had designed, or fly had designed a bee suit specifically to fool other bees or whatnot, then it's not really lying. You have to intentionally want to change the belief system of someone else. And that means you have to understand that someone else has a belief system to begin with. And that may be a very human capacity.
We've really evolved as excellent liars.
Yes. And part of what language is the ability to manipulate the thoughts of other people. So baked into our linguistic skill is the capacity for lying. and a lot of our cognition, especially social cognition, is about understanding the intentions and the thoughts of other humans. We're really... That is the basis for our intelligence, and with that comes the ability to deceive. So we are, you know, we evolved to be liars.
Do we also like to be lied to?
I don't think we like it, because we also have evolved systems to detect lying. And then there is, of course, some idea in psychology that we are generally accepting as most information as truthful, because if you thought everything was a lie, you'd be incapacitated. So most of the time we believe it's true, but we're sensitive to lies, but we're also liars. So it's a complex dance that makes us, you know, it can be quite crippling.
Well, I mean, there may be people, and I'm not going to name names, who are known liars, and yet the people who enjoy them refuse to believe that they're liars.
Yeah, you don't have to name names. I know what you mean.
Okay.
But there is that. But then there's this other concept that I don't know if I can say this on air, but so I won't, but it's called BSing, which is
psychological
scientific term. There you go, bullshitting.
Great, and there's great books written about it.
There's numerous books. It's a great concept. And that is, it's not so much lying as you are just producing a ton of information, and I don't really care whether or not you believe that it's false or true, or whether or not it actually is false or true, but it's just the idea of throwing out as much potentially correct, maybe not correct information as possible. It is a thing that we actually respect in other people. There are studies to show that if you're a good bullshit artist, you're going to do better in the business world. You're going to get high, you know, maybe even in academia. So we recognize it and respect it, because it does require some sort of mental muscle, you know, some skills to be a good bullshit artist. And so, we don't mind sometimes when people are known liars. And in fact, we respect them more. Isn't that what politics is?
On that note, we'll end. My guest tonight is Justin Gregg. He's a senior research associate with the Dolphin Communication Project and an adjunct professor at St. Francis Xavier University. And we've been talking about his incredible new book, If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal, What Animal Intelligence Reveals About Human Stupidity. It's worth reading just to find out how he treats drone bees, which I admire incredibly.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'm on your side about that. Don't let your friend can just go fly a kite.
That's right.
Justin, it's been great.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.